Mr. Padnaban.
Padnaban, thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Your Honors, before I discuss each issue in detail, here's a brief overview of why this court should reverse the district court. First, JV and Sons has a breach of contract claim based on an implied contract. The terms of such a contract is a question of fact that must...
I thought the district court said it was both an express and an implied, at least granted relief on alternative grounds.
Your Honor, there is no, you can look at the record, the district court did not expressly find an express contract. There is no express contract in this case. What they're trying to cobble together are rate sheets and email communications to basically pull together what they view are the terms of the contract. It is purely an implied contract.
So let me start with this issue because I was going to start here anyway. You ask on page, I think, 52 of your brief that we reverse in the court's order in its entirety. That includes this contract case claim.
Yes, Your Honor.
Which is a complete, you know, we got claim and counterclaim. And the district court ruled, or your challenge to the contract claim is that the contract found by the court did not exist. And if we disagree with you on that, as I understand it, there is no other contract issue. You did not present as an issue that the either the eight claims were not unpaid or the amounts were wrong and so forth. Am I right about
that's,
that?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So at that point, if we reject your existence argument, then that claim is a final judgment.
Yes, Your Honor.
So doesn't matter what we do with the other issues, which are more
legal,
more complicated.
Yes, Your Honor.
But even if we remand on that, we would be affirming a final judgment.
Yes, on this.
Then
yes,
we're
Your
on the same page.
Yes,
thank
yes.
you.
So, but in terms of the contract claim, there is no express contract. What there is an implied contract. Do you want a napkin, Your Honor? There is an implied contract. And what the court did that was incorrect was it usurped the jury's role in finding the terms of this implied contract. Now, the second issue...
That would be an issue of law under Minnesota law, wouldn't it?
I'm sorry?
Existence of a contract.
Existence of a contract is a question of law, but the underlying facts for what are the terms of the contract is a question of fact. And so here, what the judge did...
Yes, but there's no dispute as to the terms. We just agreed with that.
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor. There is a dispute as to the terms.
I know what you're saying. You're saying what was a complete contract and so forth.
Yep. So there are some terms that we can say, yes, there are rate sheets. But the problem
what was the jury issue on the contract?
So the jury issue on the contract claim is, what are the very terms of this contract? So what are the rate sheets that control? What are there actually communications that actually show a meeting of the minds? What is the role of the quick pay agreement in this agreement?
Okay, and what's your best Texas case that those, what I would call introductory issues are for a jury?
So I believe the Diamond case is the best case on point on that.
Okay.
But also, Your Honor, because there's no express contract and the terms of the contract are a question of fact, let me stay on this for 1 second. If you look at the court's order on this issue, what they rely on are rate sheets. But if you look at even the appendix at page 380 and I think 385, those are the same rate sheets. But on one of them, you'll see that JV and Sons has handwritten rates on there. But they're not signed by both parties. If you look at an example of a communication, I believe it's appendix like 385 or maybe I'll get the number for you. But one of the emails, you can see it specifically goes to looking at the proposals made by JV and Sons and asking, hey, will we agree with that proposal or not? Again, these are all questions for a jury to look at the entire context of the relationship.
That's not the whole inquiry on implied contract.
But it goes to the fundamental inquiry of implied contract, which is what are the terms the parties actually had a meeting of the minds on?
But performance can establish what those terms were. So if one looks at how the contract was performed while it was being complied with, And then you say that, well, that's consistent with the rate sheets, that's consistent with the communications that took place by email. Doesn't that, in fact, establish the terms of the contract? And at that point, doesn't the burden lie on you to show where the question of fact exists as to those terms?
It does, Your Honor. And so let me explain why the course of conduct still raises fact issues. So under the course of conduct, what you have is, other than the very first invoice, JV and Sons factored every single invoice under the quick pay agreement.
Okay, so let me ask you about that. You mentioned that the role of the quick pay agreement is something maybe the jury should consider in terms of what were the terms of this contract. But as I read the quick pay agreement, it provides on its face that it pertains to the purchase of accounts receivable by AVL from JV. Does that even apply to the hauling of crude?
Yes, it does in this case, Your Honor, because what JV and Sons specifically said, and it's the context of what the jury needs to look at, is JV and Sons said, we cannot haul for you unless we have a factoring agreement. We need to get paid earlier. And so part of the relationship, JV and Sons could not have performed its hauling services if they could not have a mechanism by which they got paid earlier.
But what does that have to do with the purchase of accounts receivable? Your briefs indicate that AVL is paying JV directly for this hauling service.
I'm sorry. So the briefs indicate, and I think the briefs...
That the payment is directly from AVL to JV. There is no third party paying JV.
Why is it
a purchase of an account receivable?
The reason that the briefs suggest that Asset Vision is directly paying JV and Sons is because of the quick pay agreement. Otherwise, the normal standard practice was that JV and Sons would have to wait until Asset Vision's customer paid Asset Vision, and then from that money, Asset Vision would pay JV and Sons.
I understand that, but it's still a direct payment.
But the main reason for that payment is the quick pay agreement, which has additional terms imposed on that relationship. And in fact, there's testimony to that effect from Mr. Hallwell for the jury to consider.
How is that the purchase of an account receivable, which is what the quick payment agreement covers?
Yep, and that's the mechanism. The purchase of the assignment of the invoice is the mechanism by which JV and Sons got paid earlier. That is the mechanism used, but it's those terms. It's the very heart of this agreement, and it's the standard practice. It's because of that agreement that JV and Sons was able to provide this service.
Where is the standard of practice in the summary judgment record?
Where is the standard of...
Yeah, oh. What you just referred to.
So it's the standard practice is just basically, if you look at the record itself, Your Honor, what they point to is they got paid on the first 350 hauls. That's what JV and Sons...
I thought you were referring to the industry. There's all kinds of references to this is the way they do it in the Texas oil country.
Oh, no, I wasn't referring to the industry, Your Honor. This is very specific. These facts that I'm giving you are...
This is the course of dealings for these parties.
These the course of dealings for these parties.
Okay.
And the course of dealings for these parties included the quick pay agreement. Moreover... I mean, just in terms of the contract terms itself and in the conduct, for each of these invoices that were actually factored and paid, there was disputes with each one, and every one of those was negotiated. And the reason I bring that up is, again, the course of conduct goes to not a set of terms, but rather a constant dispute between the parties about what needed to get paid, what did not need to get paid, and then they would get that paid. There's not a set terms that everybody agreed upon.
So your claim is essentially that the course of conduct is not sufficient to establish the terms of the contract because the contract was in a constant state of flux and negotiation.
That's correct, Your Honor. And to go one step further, the course of conduct must include, or the jury must at least have to consider, the role of the quick pay agreement in it, given its central role in JV and Sons being able to even have a relationship with Asset Vision, and the role it played in the actual transaction of how JV and Sons got paid during the term of the on the invoices that it did get paid on. And so for those reasons, there is a fact issue on the actual terms of the agreement. Also, if you look at the district court's analysis on this issue, and we go through this in our brief in detail, there's no rate sheet that's signed, and I gave you that distinction, but if you look at the communications, even if you look at the citation to our answer in the Texas court, the district court cites to the first half saying we've agreed to rate sheets, but not to the second half of that very same statement that says we don't think the rate sheets are the single term in this contract, and it at least includes the quick pay agreement, words to that effect. And the reason I bring that up is in the district court's own order, by not addressing the rest of what Asset Vision has said in a pleading, it shows the fact issue that's there. Asset Vision truly believes that the terms of the contract are beyond the rate sheets. JV and Sons is going with just the rate sheets. That is an issue for the jury to decide on what are the terms of this agreement. With that, let me, Your Honor, I'll reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
You're not going to reach the...
I'll go ahead and reach it.
Well, no, then counsel shouldn't talk about it.
Oh, if no, counsel I'll reach talk I'll about do the second.
It, you can't talk about rebuttal.
Okay.
Let me ask you this, counsel. What confidential information does Asset Vision allege that was disclosed here?
So the confidential information is twofold, Your Honor. It's PIN codes, which are very customer-specific, site-specific information that the driver needs to be able to access the site location. And it's also safety information that Asset Vision then summarizes for the driver in a way for the driver to use and be able to use it so that they can access the site correctly. So those are the pieces of information. The Baker case is a very good example of why those type of pieces of information are confidential.
And Delek provided this to your client?
Delek provided it to our client, and then our client then provided it to the driver. And that's why we don't believe the Non-Compete Act should have been used to decide the enforceability of the non-compete provision. But more importantly, the district court never addressed the argument that Texas recognizes goodwill as an interest, and the non-compete provision enforces the return promise.
The district court didn't have to say that.
The district court, but it's an actual reason, and the district court never addressed it, and that's in the record, and that's a basis on which you can find, or a jury could find, that there is non-solicitation provision enforces a return promise, which in this case is the non-disclosure agreement.
Does Texas allow the enforcement of a general provision of goodwill, or do they limit it to the sale of goodwill in the context of a business?
Texas, I believe under Marsh, Your Honor, allows for goodwill to be a protectable interest.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of sale, I can only answer it in the context of trademarks, Your Honor, that it allows for the sale of goodwill as part of the trademark transaction. Mm-hmm. I don't know more generally than that.
Thank you.
And then lastly, on the non-disclosure agreement, Your Honor, Texas law is very clear. There are no prerequisites. You can look at the Zepp case for that. But more importantly, if you look at the district court's analysis, all of the cases the district court relies upon, none of them found the non-disclosure agreement to be unenforceable. And in fact, all of them enforced the non-disclosure agreement at some level in a preliminary injunction context. Unless you have other questions, that's all I have.
Mr. Gleagle.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. The issue I have with counsel's analysis of the contract claim is this. If you look at the appendix at pages 377 to 382.
You have to speak up.
I'm sorry. If you look at the appendix at pages 377 to 382, the rate sheets are there. The argument that's been advanced by AVL's counsel seems to be that there was a rate. There's one rate that doesn't.
Still can't hear you.
There was a rate. One rate does not form a contract, and therefore the district court was mistaken with respect to the contract formation. But if you look at the actual rate sheet agreements, and there were three, covering different time periods in different locations throughout the state. There are specific rates, not only for mileage, but the minimum amount of oil barrels to be hauled, the reject rate charges, etc. And I think in their effort to convince this court to overturn Judge Menendez's summary judgment on the contract claim, they have overstated what occurred. The district court properly found that you had not only the rate sheet agreements, but you did have a course of conduct. You had a course of conduct whereby the invoices were submitted to AVL, and tellingly, Mr. Hallwell, the sole LLC member, has admitted repeatedly on the record that the money was owed. Well, if there was no contract, why would AVL admit that this money was owed? Pursuant to the...
Where is that in the record? It's probably in your brief.
It is in my brief, Your Honor. And the court...
The deposition testimony.
Yes, there's a cite to that. And really what counsel is pointing to is this. JVS, my client, would submit an invoice to AVL with respect to the rate sheets. Like any invoice, and on these invoices, there were a number of these amounts that were charged pursuant to the rate sheets. And what the record showed was what there might be a disagreement, for example, and this was the big one on the record, and I don't have the cite, Your Honor, was wait times. You charged, my client charged AVL for X minutes or X hours of wait time, and AVL took issue with that one line item on an invoice. That's what was the subject of discussion, not whether or not there was a contract, not whether or not there was a dispute as to the terms of the contract, and I'm going to repeat myself again, not whether or not those invoices, once those specific line items had been addressed, was payable, was a valid invoice pursuant to the agreement, was payable by AVL to JVS. And I'm perplexed by the argument with respect to the contract given this record. Now, if the court doesn't have any questions, Your Honor had asked what the confidential information was.
Well, let me ask a more general question.
Yes, Your Honor.
The district court treated the non-disclosure clause effectively as a covenant not to compete.
Yes.
That's probably the most novel part of this case. Can you address why it should be treated as a covenant not to compete, and then also what information is alleged to have been disclosed?
Happily. The district court properly treated the non-disclosure, the confidentiality provision, as a covenant not to compete, given the incredible breadth of that provision. The non-disclosure agreement, if I may read it, because to highlight the overbreadth of this provision, is it says not to disclose any confidential information to any other person or use any confidential information, etc. This is the key. The agreement itself purports to define confidential information as, quote, all information, whether written or oral, that is disclosed or made available to seller, in this case my client, JV & Sons Trucking, directly or indirectly through any means of communication, including seller's observations by virtue of opportunities provided to seller by purchaser. In a nutshell, anything my client allegedly learned while it was hauling oil for Delek, a company that my client had hauled oil for prior to any relationship with AVL, is defined by the agreement as confidential. Function.
Texas law have a blue pencil doctrine?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I mean, AVL hasn't argued it.
Well, but that's how you pare down overbroad covenants in some states.
That is true, Your Honor. I don't know how you would.
That's not, nobody looked at that here.
Nobody looked at that. There was no argument by AVL that the court had the opportunity to blue pencil this confidentiality provision. And with all due respect to the court, given the breadth of this provision, I don't know how a district court could blue pencil this provision. But to get back to your question, Your Honor, what is purportedly defined as confidential information essentially is a non-compete. Anything my client learned, whether it was in documents, whether it was truly confidential, whether they observed it. Let me give you an example. Under this definition, if one of my client's drivers went from point A to point B to pick up oil, that route that that driver determined to take would be, under this provision, an observation that was learned while hauling oil for Delek through ABL, and therefore, under this provision, would be treated as confidential information by ABL. So that's why the court properly applied the analysis under Texas law that this was a, functionally, was a non-compete. Now, if we then turn to a significant part of the lower court's decision as to whether or not the non-solicitation provision was related to a reasonable protectable interest, we need to take a look at what ABL argued. ABL argued that the non-solicitation provision was related to a reasonable restriction, the restriction being the confidentiality provision. They've argued we needed the non-solicitation provision to maintain the confidentiality of this overbroad provision in the quick pay agreement. But what the district court properly looked at was that my client, JV and Sons Trucking, had hauled for Delek through AVL for 2 months prior to ever signing the quick pay agreement. Now, if AVL was fine with my client hauling oil for Delek 2 months prior to signing the quick pay agreement on which AVL hangs its hat with respect to the restrictive covenants, then it defies logic and common sense that the quick pay agreement was necessary for a reasonable restriction, apart from the unreasonableness of the restrictions themselves.
Does the quick pay agreement even apply outside the context of the purchase of receivables?
District court found that it did. I question whether it does, Your Honor. We argued below, and the district court did not accept this argument, as Your Honor had observed. That quick pay agreement is its subject matter, its object, are my client's invoices to AVL. AVL is factoring its own invoices. That's what that quick pay agreement does.
And use of the word factor is not in the briefs. It's in the district court's opinion, and it doesn't relate to my understanding of that word in other contexts.
Well, it doesn't because I understand why you're saying that, Your Honor, because generally you wouldn't have a company like ABL factoring its own invoices. So let's just refer to it as the quick pay agreement.
I can't. You just have to speak.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
It's my age, I guess.
I have, other than this situation, it's not your typical factoring arrangement where if I am a merchant and I need money to run my business, I go out and find a factoring agent and then I sell them my receivables. Here, AVL is in essence purchasing its payables for a 3% discount. And that is the object of the quick pay agreement. It states it on the first page of the quick pay agreement. It refers to the purchase and sale of those receivables, those invoices. So I question, and I do, Your Honor, whether or not the quick pay agreement has any reference to the hauling arrangement. They're two separate commercial relationships. On the one hand, you're hauling oil pursuant to the rate agreements, etc. On the other hand, my client is selling, if you will, its invoices.
Well, payment terms are terms of a contract.
They are.
The QPA deals with the one aspect of the payment terms for future transactions, doesn't it?
If my client chooses to avail itself of the quick pay agreement with respect to any particular invoice.
Yeah, and if Asset Vision chooses to use your client as the hauler.
Well,
it's free enterprise on both sides.
No, there is, and I would make a friendly amendment to that. And again, I go back to the fact that for 2 months prior to the parties signing the quick pay agreement, my client was hauling for Delek through AVL, and AVL paid on those invoices. And again, I take issue with counsel that my client...
Your client wanted different payment terms, and Asset Vision imposed some conditions and restrictions on that.
With respect to the payment, I agree.
Well, in an agreement that included other terms.
With respect to the payments, yes. And then there was the non-solicitation and the confidentiality provision in the quick pay agreement. Every other provision...
If there had been a written contract to begin with, there would have been those terms, probably, unless your client had refused to sign it.
If there had been another written agreement with respect to payment and payment in net 15 or net 30 or what have you, yes. The record reflects that originally my client was paid on a net 15. And then it was told, we're not going to pay you on a net 15 anymore. You're going to have to wait. But if you want to get paid earlier, here's a quick pay agreement. So, yes, I agree with that. I do.
Well, if there had been a written contract that said net 15, then your client would have had a stronger position.
With respect.
They just said, that term is not going to apply in the future. And there's no written agreement, so now the bargaining resumes.
With respect to the payment term? Yes.
Well, with respect to the relationship, which included payment terms.
I'm having trouble following that, Your Honor.
Well, I'm having trouble with the way that both sides have dissected the course of dealings here and into convenient legal arguments.
Let me ask you a question, because
what
Judge Loken's saying, I'm now a little bit confused. And the question really is this, is that if an agreement is indefinite as to the terms of payment, is the agreement otherwise enforceable as a contract, as a contract to haul oil?
My position would be yes, it is, because it is the timing of payment would be a reasonable amount of time. And if there was no term, then we could do, as we learned in law school, a gap filler. We'd look at the industry as to what's reasonable.
An unjust enrichment lawsuit if you have.
Well, that's true. That's true.
But as far as contract law, you'd be looking to imply a term of reasonable time for performance and a reasonable price for hauling. And is that really a contract at that point? Or is it a series of contracts being negotiated over and over again?
No, my position would be, in this situation, because everything was in the rate agreements, the amount of charges were in the rate agreements, we're focusing only on the timing of payment and whether or not when a payment is due for services that have been rendered pursuant to agreed upon rates, it would be a reasonable period of time. In other words, a gap filler. That would be what I would presume would be the law. That's what would apply in this situation, but for the quick pay agreement. Does that answer your question?
It does.
Okay. If your honors have no further questions, I know I've got 28 seconds. I don't need to say anything more. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Pat Manabon, I have a quick question, and it's about the covenant not to compete being implied in the solicitation agreement and Marsh. And Marsh reflects a citation to 15.50 of the business code. And in 15.50 subdivision A, it talks about covenants not to compete have to be part of an otherwise enforceable agreement, that it's that it has to have reasonable limitations as to time, geographical area, and the scope of activity to be restrained, that are reasonable and do not impose greater restraint than necessary to protect the goodwill And so the issue at this point is if we're inferring out of the non-solicitation agreement the covenant not to compete, where do we find the terms that are necessary? That is the limitation as to time, geographical area, and scope of activity.
Your Honor, so in terms of time, the contract is for... Sorry, I just had it in my... Let me start with the geographic scope first. So the way the non-solicitation provision works is you can't solicit people that we've introduced you to or our clients. Mm-hmm. And what that effectively does is it limits them to 5 clients, and that's why it's a very limited scope of non-solicitation. And basically, it's parts of Texas is I think what it comes out to.
And so the geographic limitation is inherent in the 5 clients, right? You look at where they're doing business; those are the geographic bounds.
Yep. And the time period the contract is for, I think it's 180. It expires 180 days after. After termination. So I don't know that there's a long term. I don't think that was one of the issues that they raised down below in terms of a problem with the contract. It was really the scope of it. And the scope of it really just comes down to these 5 people. And if you don't solicit those 5 or 6 clients, I think it's 5 or 6 in the record. That's all there is to it.
Thank you.
Is there anything else, Your Honor? I think I'm out of time.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
The case has been thoroughly briefed. Argument's been helpful. It's not an easy case to sort out. We will take it under advisement and do our best with it.